Yo.
And why are there Bernie bros and not Bernie hoes?
So there are.
Did we talk about having edibles at my holiday party?
And that I always underestimated is that men really like breasts.
Do you think I'm a Karen?
Valentine's Day is like New Year's Eve with nuclear weapons.
What you just said was so slut-shaming. And I wanted to
see how it's slut-shaming. Welcome to the Femsplainers. I'm Danielle Crittenden. And welcome to what I want to call our version of That 70s Show. The inspiration for this week's theme comes from a new memoir by Erica Schickel called The Big Hurt. Now, Erica is the daughter of the late famous film critic Richard Schickel, who wrote for many years, decades even, for Time magazine, and the novelist Julia Whedon. And Erica also, like me, came of age in the 1970s. We are the Gen Xers, grew up as little sisters and brothers to the baby boomers, gave birth to millennials and Gen Zers. And I just feel that our story never really gets told, because when we look back on the history of the 70s, we tend to focus on the women's movement and the sexual revolution and the huge impact these movements had on our culture and still have. But lost in there are the stories of the kids who witnessed what seemed like the whole adult world taking a huge pass on traditional parenting and grown-up responsibilities. Many of us were the products of divorce, the children of the first wave of middle-class mothers who went back to work, you know, first time since World War II. Also the so-called latchkey kids. We were largely left to fend for ourselves during daylight hours. We were the ones who came home from school at lunchtime to empty houses and apartments. I became an expert cook of craft dinner. But I should stress that we didn't all experience this as neglect or abandonment. It was all we ever knew, and the very opposite of today's helicopter parenting. We learned early on to be independent and resourceful with little expectation that our parents' role was to drive us to school or meddle in our education or wonder where we were until dinner time or mediate between us children and the adult world. I mostly experienced the state of nature as liberating, but it did have its generational toll. When Erica's parents divorced, they packed her up to a bohemian boarding school in the Berkshires. And as the book notes on its flap, The Big Hurt tells two coming-of-age stories, one of a lost girl in the predatory world of 1970s Manhattan, and the other of that girl grown up who ends up recreating her past with a notorious LA crime novelist, blowing up her marriage, and casting herself into the second exile of her life. So I thought an interesting pairing for our cocktail segment this episode would be to bring my husband, David Frum, back to the program. Well, many know David for his books and writings in The Atlantic about politics and the Republican Party. Few realize he is the author of a definitive history of the 1970s. It's called How We Got Here, The Decade That Brought You Modern Life for Better or Worse. And I think one of our strongest and earliest connections grew out of our mutual childhoods spent growing up in 1970s Toronto. So I'm going to bring him on first and set the scene and pour, what should I pour him? A white wine spritzer? Anyway, let's bring on David. David Frum, welcome back to the Femsplainers.
Well, what a thrill to be allowed to take part, because normally you record on our third floor with a big no boys allowed sign on the door. So I'm very honored to be in the inner sanctum.
Well, it is a bit of a girl's tree fort most of the time. But, you know, as I said to our listeners, people don't realize this about you, but you actually wrote the book on the 70s, the book on the 70s.
Well, we are recording this on the day that, as it happened, I just got my royalty statement for the book. And although it was published now more than 20 years ago and was not a huge commercial success, I'm chuffed, you know, a couple of times a year to get the statement that shows a few hundred people have tuned in.
But like $8.09.
No, this time I did a little better. But no, so there are 235 people who bought a paperback or electronic edition of How We Got Here in the past 6 months, or the 6 months ending June 30th. So I take my hat off to each and every one.
Well, and I'm a little sore because I feel that was one of your best books. Yes. It was also the only book you dedicated to me, and it did the least well. So yeah. I hope that's not a curse. But anyway, to the 70s.
Yes.
So what made you decide to dive into that decade? What was so compelling to you about it, given that we lived through it as children?
If I had to put one moment on it, I remember it would be a moment in 1974, 1975. My parents were out for dinner, and I got a call from one of my parents' close friends who had obviously too much to drink and who was just going through the, as people did in those days, dialing and dialing and dialing until he found someone to talk to, and he found me. And he went into this extraordinary confession or self-accusation about how things would never be as good again and how all of human history was in decline from the year 1974. And things in 1974 did seem in many ways pretty grim. And so it sounded quite credible to me. And so I ended up spending a lot of time thinking about that conversation. And when I wanted to try my hand at writing a history of our times, the idea of bracketing that period. I think it was also because the very dramatic period of the 1960s has been written to death and written about in documentary. I always think that, I mean, you see, it's always that bird song, the soundtrack to the song to everything.
There is a season.
Right. And then we cut to Woodstock and helicopters in Vietnam. And that's all been done. But at the time that I wrote about it, the period after had not. And let me say one last thing. I know this is too long an answer, but when you think about it, and when you sort of set up the interview you're doing today, that it is really the 1970s when the post-war era begins. If you turn 20 in 1970, you were born after the war and the depression. You were born in 1950 after the war depression. But even if you turned 40 in 1970, you had certainly been, or if you were in North America, too young for the war, and you'd been through the depression as a child, but it wasn't necessarily very real to you. And so this is this new period of individualism, of expression, of being a little less concerned about economic security than older people had been, and a little more interested in discovering themselves.
Right. And I also remember just how everything seemed to turn crappy during that decade. That, I mean, we were kids, so you don't think of a child as having much of an aesthetic sensibility, but even as like an 8-year-old, I thought everything was crappy and bad, from the cement block buildings that were going up to the really cheesy, because there were these new things coming in, right? Like polyester clothes,
right.
Vinyl.
Affordable orange and purple dyes.
Yes, affordable orange and purple dyes. And you know, coupled with this, I guess we had the oil crisis, we had...
And it's before the quality revolution.
Right.
So I have a section in the book where I talk about this image of the 70s imagining an AMC Gremlin with the 8-track cassette player broken and the tape spilling all over the orange interior of the car.
And, yeah, the Gremlin.
And the doors didn't close properly. That beginning in the 80s, we would have this quality revolution because of Japanese competition, where everyday products began to be better and better made. But this was a period in which everyday products became worse and worse made.
And why was that?
I think part of it was, there was a crisis in labor relations. I mean, for cars especially, there was a real problem of worker resistance on the assembly line. So there'd be sabotage and damage. And so the cars would be badly made and they'd be fixed up at the end and a fancy coat of paint applied. I think it was a lot of new products becoming available in a way that was that hadn't been assimilated yet, as you say, about the dyes. Part of it was, it was this true post-war era where we still had to build. We had to build a lot of things very fast, housing and office buildings for cities. And you had this huge change because of the move to the Sun Belt in the United States, huge new cities being built almost overnight with very little time. And I think there was also, because of the crisis in the price of raw materials, it's not just oil that goes up, but every kind of raw material becomes more expensive in the 1970s. So you just, you know, that sense of, well, this used to be solid because metal was once cheap and now there's a lot less metal in it. So it's less solid because the price of metal is really more expensive in 1975 than it was in 1965. All those things come together.
Yeah. And nobody really wants to collect 1970s cars, do they? You sort of skip back. I mean, I'm sure there are, obviously, but it was the ugliest era for cars.
Well, I think when people collect them, they collect them ironically. Yeah. So there's a kind of sense of, you know, just the sheer ugliness is its own kind of statement.
The Lincoln Continental Mark IV.
Yeah, the Ford Thunderbird. Remember that, which started off in the 50s as, you know, a fun little two seater that the Beach Boys sing about. And then it becomes this bigger and bigger behemoth. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a TV show. I think it was called Cannon. About a private detective who was this very unattractive, physically unattractive specimen. And he drove a success, like the Mercury Cougar, just the ugliest. And there's this homely detective in bad suits in this hideous car. Yeah. And yeah, that sort of sums up a lot of how we felt about it.
Right. And the food was fluorescent colors too. Yes. Even though there were hippies and granola, eating healthy was sort of seen as a hippie thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, our fridge was filled with Kool-Aid and sodas and square, bright orange yes. cheese and Jell-O. And we were still eating as yes. if it was just the immediate post-war.
Yeah.
And I think you wrote in the book, too, that this was the era that your parents, my parents, would soon discover cappuccino for the first time. Like, so the food revolution just starts to come in the
Well, this is 70s. Where our families had come with somewhat different sensibilities, because my parents were early adopters on all the hippie food stuff and whole grains. And so going back, my parents were very caught up in, I've complained about this on the Family Planet before, that my parents had rules about toys, that if it was made of plastic, it was advertised on television, and if it was sold by a corporation, you couldn't have it. but that sensibility, my parents were real early on that one. But by 1977, that quite a lot of middle class people or upper middle class professional people have the attitude my mother had in 1967 of, if it's sold, advertised on TV, you can't have it.
Right. And it was just starting that people were giving up cigarettes and starting to get fit, the jogging
and the environmental revolution. And the 70s were, because it was this time of expressive individualism, it was also a time of apocalyptic theories and ends of the world. And so a lot of, there are parts of environmentalism that are obviously very rational and very scientific, but the belief that you were going to die from things, that really spread and went with that era's fascination with the occult, the Bermuda Triangle in Atlantis. All of that stuff came back in. And there had been, and maybe Vietnam was the reason for this, there had been this kind of discrediting of rational control, of the idea of orderly mathematical or scientific processes applied, that Vietnam had somehow discredited, I think it was Vietnam, if I had to point my finger, that feeling. And there was this desire for things, again, that were more expressive, that were more rooted in nature, that were more non-geometric in their form. Less predictable. And some of that stuff was, I think, of enduring beauty and worth, but a lot of it was pretty wacky.
Right. Also the era of the big disaster movie, like
big disaster movie.
Towering Inferno and the Poseidon Adventure. But it was also, I mean, you and I, we had, you know, devoted parents, but we did run feral. I mean, there was also a kind of step away of adult oversight, responsibility.
Right. Well, this is the era where adults decided to live for themselves. So, I mean, and with the other interviews you're doing in mind, I mean, I think there was a period where, just because of the pressure, the difficulty of life, adults live for their communities. And then in the modern era where we are so child obsessed, parents live in and for their children. But there was this period where parents decided, I'm living in and for myself. And I quote in the book a lot of how the advertising of the time spoke to it. There was a hair care commercial. The slogan was, "If I only have one life to live, I'm going to live it as a blonde."
That's my philosophy.
and this I do for me. So you have this combination of different kinds of social movements coming together where the adult world just went into rebellion against the idea of obligations to other people, including their children.
Yeah. No, and I don't feel, and this just might be my own ignorance, But I don't feel that we've really reckoned with memoir. Like, so I'm excited to have Erica on the program because I haven't seen a lot of memoirs from that period, from a child's perspective. I think we both agree that The Ice Storm was the best movie made about the 70s from perspective.
As one gets older, you also see how things reverberate time after time and how one generation's traumas or upsets create reactions in the next, which then create reactions in the next. And the past sort of comes closer. And so, you know, that that generation, the people came of age in the 70s and wanted to live for themselves. We also saw, remember we watched Mad Men together, that we kept remarking, now we understand why these kids, the two kids in the, who are going to be the helicopter parents from the 90s. And we know why they're going to be so constantly on top of their own children. No one was on top of them.
Right, right. Yeah, I experienced it as a kind of freedom. But when I go back and dig deep, some of it was kind of dark, too.
So it was kind of dark.
Anyway, well, David, I was going to offer you a spritzer, but you helped yourself to a gin and tonic before before coming on.
Well, that's true. Gin wasn't a drink of the 70s, but clear liquors were. One of the big shocks of the 1970s is the transition from brown liquors to clear liquors. People had this idea that clear liquors were somehow healthier. Vodka was better for you than scotch.
Well, fewer calories, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. I think they somehow thought it was like, you were less likely to have a hangover from it. So in that spirit.
Okay. All right. Well, cheers, David. Thank you for coming on and giving us the anthropological, cultural, historical view.
Thanks for letting me into the Treeport.
I recently received a brand new complete security system for my home from SimpliSafe. That's right. It arrived in a big cardboard box and it contained absolutely everything I need to protect our home, from a camera doorbell to motion sensors and even a key fob. Best of all, it didn't require any sort of professional to install it. I could do it myself easily, and that's saying something. Well, now SimpliSafe just launched their new wireless outdoor security camera. That's right, SimpliSafe, the system that U.S. News and World Report named Best Home Security Systems of 2021, just got even better. This brand new wireless outdoor security camera is engineered with all the advanced tech and security features you want and need to help you keep you and your family safe. It has an ultra-wide 140-degree field of view so you can keep watch over your entire yard. It has a 1080p HD resolution with an 8x zoom. That means you can zoom in and clearly see things like faces and license plates to capture critical evidence. And it has a built-in spotlight with color night vision, so you can keep an eye on what's going on day and night. And it has a two-way audio so you can speak to or even scare off someone who comes on your property. And it really is super simple to set up. It usually just takes minutes, no wiring, and the camera has an easy-to-remove rechargeable battery, so it doesn't need an outlet and can go anywhere on your property. This camera has it all, and it integrates with your SimpliSafe home system, extending its comprehensive protection to the outside. Together, it means every door, window, and room are protected, and now your property will be too. The new SimpliSafe wireless outdoor security system takes whole home security to a whole new level. So, to learn about the exciting new SimpliSafe wireless outdoor security camera, visit SimpliSafe, that's SimpliSafe, SimpliSafe.com/femsplainers. What's more, SimpliSafe is celebrating this new camera by offering 20% off your entire new system and your first month of monitoring service free when you enroll in interactive monitoring. Again, that's SimpliSafe with an I, SimpliSafe. FE.com/femsplainers.
Okay, well, after that, I'm very keen to bring on Erica Schickel. Again, her book is The Big Hurt, a memoir. And just a reminder, as always, if you're enjoying the podcast and enjoying these conversations, please consider becoming a supporter of the Femsplainers at patreon.com/femsplainers. It's a friendship with benefits, in addition to getting a monthly bonus episode in which you get to ask our guest questions. You'll also get our monthly newsletter And at certain levels of contribution, you can get this podcast ad early and ad free. So again, please consider supporting the Femsplainers at patreon.com/femsplainers. And also give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or write a nice review. Combat the haters who are out there. And we're grateful for anything, any contribution you can make. Okay, let's bring on Erica. Erica, welcome to the Femsplainers.
Danielle, what a thrill to be here. I love this show.
Well, thank you. I was saying to you just as we were setting up, a memoir of childhood in the 1970s. There have been so few of those. Maybe it's just our time now to start writing these memoirs, but the 70s from a child's perspective is... I feel like it was the era when the adult world just got up and walked out of the house, you know, quite literally.
Literally they did.
And
or
left us kids.
Shoved us out the right. front door and said, come back later.
Yeah.
And in my case, years. Or never.
I know. It was quite a time. So let's talk about your time in it. You grew up in 1970s Manhattan, which those of us who remember Manhattan in the 70s, that was the era of graffitied subway cars. It was grime. It was filthy. Everything felt like it was going to hell. And there you were, young Erica. Your dad was a famous movie critic, Richard Schickel. Your mother was a novelist, and you were kind of living this bohemian life in New York.
Yeah, I mean, let's recall that in the 1970s, we still had in America a thing known as the upper middle class, which is where my family lived, you know, existed. It was a life of privilege, but not extreme privilege. It was a life really of intellectual privilege because of my parents. And my father was a very hardworking freelance writer. He never joined the staff at Time Magazine or any place else. He was always against it. So my privileged childhood was paid for through a typewriter. You know, it was not inherited wealth. And so New York in those days was just a really different place, you know, for a kid. My experience was both sort of protected and completely vulnerable in that city and that time.
Right. And no, it was a time when, I mean, for journalism, and it was heady to be, because journalists could actually afford to live in Manhattan.
Yes.
And there was this sort of lively literary life. And and it was definitely the 70s were being chronicled by so many New York publications. But so you grew up in this household. And as you say, I grew up in a household also that of journalists. And it is a very privileged upbringing because you get used to conversations and meeting people and ideas and just being exposed to so many things but yet it wasn't a lavish life. It wasn't a life of wealth.
Again, I mean, by economic standards, you know, of today, I mean, at one point, there was a brief moment that I detail in the book where we lived in a brownstone on 95th. Street between Park and Lexington. And that would have been completely unattainable to my family today. But, you know, then, you know, with, you know, a good loan from the grandparents and all of that, you know, my parents could actually buy that house. Of course, then they sold it in the divorce, which is perhaps the greatest tragedy of my childhood, is that we sold that house.
Imagine if they'd hung on to it.
Oh my God, we would be millionaires. But it didn't work out that way, alas.
But like so many, your parents got divorced. You were about to, like you were 12, I think, or 13. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was born in a 64. So really, yeah, it was around 76 that my parents split up, and it was a zeitgeist divorce. I mean, everybody was doing it. And my parents, I was the first among my friends, you know, I was an early adapter of being a divorced kid. But, you know, in the next 5 years is like everybody's marriage split up. Yeah.
And then that led you to probably act out more than you might have, but but then you were also creative and and it sounded like, you know, you're the eldest. So tell us what happened and how your parents handled it with you.
Well, I did, as they say, act out, as kids of divorce will do. And I was about 12 going on 13. My parents just completely turned away from the family, both of them in their own way. And my father moved out and did his swinging bachelor thing, which I was always very aware of. And I was sort of in on his swinging lifestyle in the sense that I knew he was dating. I knew he was looking at women, you know, he was very open with me about all of that. And then my mother went and moved in with my best friend's father. And this is the first of three such incidences in my life where my parents ended up creating romantic alliances with parents of my friends. So when my friend stopped talking to me because she was so mad that her father was now living with me and my mother and my sister, that was my first heartbreak, a genuine heartbreak. But even more profound than that was the fact that something happened to my mother when I reached puberty, that she stopped trusting me. And she pushed me away and compounded by my shoplifting and, you know, hanging out unsupervised with boys and sneaking around as I was doing. She concluded that I was a danger to her and that I should be sent away for the summer, which I did. My father wangled me a job working as an au pair for the children of his British publisher. So I got shipped off to London to take care of a 2-year-old girl and a 2-month-old baby. And, you know, halfway through that experiment, I did some more shoplifting, this time at Topshop in Oxford Circus, got caught, sent back to the United States, which was my goal. And when I got back, I was told, sorry, you're not going back to the Dalton School, which is where I had been since kindergarten. You'll be going to the Buxton School, this boarding school in Williamstown, Massachusetts. So that's how I ended up there.
Right. Your descriptions of your dad in his little safari suit, leading the swinging life.
Yes.
And your mother, I mean, it was just some of the ideas of that time was it was like mothers deciding, I don't need to be a mother. I need to be me. I need to discover who I am. Ditto the father saying, yeah, me too. And I'm going to go. I think he told you that he had sex. He told you. And they brought us into it. Like, no, yes. Thank you. We don't want to hear this. We're your kids. But like he said, I had three women today.
He would tell me like about how many conquests he had. And his one big piece of fatherly advice to me when I was, you know, probably 15, I think, he said to me, Erica, there's only one thing you need to know about men. When their dicks stand up, their brains fall in the mud. That was my advice. My mother, on the other hand, I mean, I think my father was fully at liberty, you know, after the divorce. I mean, he was rolling high. He was Dick Schickel. He was a regular reviewer at Time Magazine. He went from Life to Time. His career just bloomed and burgeoned, and he slept with many wonderful ladies and ended up fine. Now, my mother, on the other hand, and I feel like this is sort of a gender difference that happened in the 70s, you know, the culture affected, or the sexual revolution affected women profoundly and differently. And I mentioned this in the book that, you know, my mother had been raised, I say, with the factory settings of the 1950s, had married in the early 60s. And slid right into that role of wife and mother and all of those expectations of the time in which she'd been raised. But all of a sudden, here was the sexual revolution. And there is a sense that the arrangement she made on the terms of the 50s was no longer an agreeable one to her, you know? And she always had a sense of, having had something taken from her. I mean, not specifically sexually, which is later revealed, she had become a victim herself of a professor in a school. But I think that she just wasn't in the same position that my father was to sort of bounce back or bounce through the sexual revolution. Right. You know, she was stuck.
Well, that's like a whole metaphor for women and the sexual revolution and how it didn't work out quite the way we wanted it to. But that being said, we, as kids, you sort of say, yeah, you go, mom, you find your empowerment, but I'm still your kid. I'm still here. I still need you to be a mother. No. And instead, you got shipped off to this boarding school, which you ended up thriving at. But it was also this 1970s. I mean, pot smoking, kids dressed in, you know, I think you had Shetland sweaters.
Oh, my God. And shit kickers, ripped jeans, boys in skirts, girls out in the smoking area, hawking up chewing tobacco. You know, I mean, it was as bohemian and nuts as a place I've ever been. And I felt madly, madly in love with it.
Right. Yeah. And also the teachers of the time, very liberal, very, mm-hmm. not a lot of supervision, not a lot of rules.
Customs, not rules at the Boston School. Customs.
Right. Right. Yeah. Rules were sort of frowned upon back then. That was.
Yeah. Well, actually the Buxton School had been started in the late 1920s, as, you know, a progressive humanistic school. The woman who founded it really saw it as sort of a refuge where children might find meaning and employment in through work and education and community, things that had been denied to them at home, right? You know, we had a big work program. It was self-sufficiency was a big theme, and figuring things out as a community was a big theme. So it was very different from my sort of strange, isolated childhood in New York. It was radically different.
But you went there, and as kids do, with this image of yourself as a total fuck up, you know, that the behavior that you were doing, the shoplifting, the sneaking around, whatever mm-hmm. else, and we all did that in the 70s. It wasn't even sneaking around because your parents often just didn't know where you were and didn't care. But you took that all upon yourself as this failure to her parents, that, you know, you were always the one messing up. You were the one, you know, getting sent home from a job your father had set up for you. And then talk about what went on to happen to you at this school.
Well, let's not forget promiscuity in all of this, you know, because that's really the hallmark of my early through all, end of adolescence, you know, and of that culture where, I was a promiscuous kid. I lost my virginity at 13. And after school in an empty apartment, the boys' parents weren't there. My parents had no idea where I was. I mean, and that was not unusual, just the way it was. It continued when I got to Buxton. You know, I had, you know, now I think by today's standards, maybe I didn't sleep with that many people, but certainly compared to my cohort, I got early labeled as a slut. I got labeled as a slut before I had even lost my virginity back at the Dalton School. So, you know, these sort of labels, this self-image, you know, at that age, it really burns itself right into your soul and becomes, you internalize that. And it was compounded by my mother sort of agreeing that I was a naughty, fucked up, bad girl. And yeah, so that ended up forming my identity which I carried all the way into adulthood. It took me years and years and years to get away from that self-identification.
Have you ever thought that you'd prefer that your bank was less like a bank? Like all those hidden fees and fine print, difficult to use mobile apps, weeks to open an account, chatbots and automated phone quote-unquote support, charge $3 per transfer and up to $25 for incoming wires, and charge $3 to use out-of-network ATMs. Well, small business owners, startups, freelancers, entrepreneurs, do you know what the number one way to avoid all of this is? Step one, close your account. Step two, open a new Novo free business account. Because Novo is the number one business banking app, because it's built from the ground up to be powerfully simple and free business banking that Money Magazine has called the best business checking account of 2021. With Novo, there are no minimum balances, no transaction limits, and no hidden fees. Sign up for free in under 10 minutes at banknovo.com/FEM, F-E-M, and then they'll mail you a Novo debit credit card and you get free ATM use. Novo makes banking easy and secure. You can manage your account in Novo's customizable web, Android, and iOS apps with built-in profit-first accounting and invoicing. Plus, you can tag each transaction and upload receipts. Novo's already changed business banking for over 100,000 small businesses. Money Magazine also calls it the best business bank account, and it won the Banker's Award for most innovative bank in North America. That's not least because Novo seamlessly integrates with most leading business tools and services like Stripe, Shopify, QuickBooks, and more for free. Plus, Novo offers over $5,000 in perks and discounts just for signing up. So get your free business banking account in just 10 minutes at banknovo.com/FEM, F-E-M. Go to banknovo.com/FEM to sign up for free right now and get a free copy of Novo's Small Business Starter Guide. That's banknovo.com/FEM.
Well, and it's also now we realize that divorce, it's very common for daughters of divorce to become promiscuous. Mm-hmm. And then instead what you were getting were, God, you reprinted some of his letters to you in full. Fascinated the sort of father trying to tell it straight to his daughter about what a fuck up she is. And
yeah.
Don't fuck up again. And we all love you, Erica, but you're really fucking us up. You know, it was just geez, Dad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
no responsibility on your side, I see, for this.
It was crazy. That letter actually was in reference to, you know, I wanted to come home for the summer from boarding school. Right. And I couldn't be with my mother because we were fighting so much. And my father was the good parent. He was the one that I really identified with and who really showed up for me and genuinely loved me. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind. Right. But that didn't mean he was any good at loving me. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, yeah. So he had just engaged an affair with an actress out in LA named Donna Winter, who was famous for being the girl in the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah. I looked her up. She was very pretty.
She was gorgeous, and she was a lovely, lovely woman. I mean, my younger sister actually got to know her better than I did, but she was lovely. So anyway, my dad is trying to levy this thing and come out to the coast, and he's just beginning his television producing career. So he wants to be, you know, skying out for confabs, not like dealing with his sort of recalcitrant, naughty, sullen daughter, you know. So he wrote me this letter that is just an extraordinary example of gaslighting as you'll ever see. It was really quite something. And everybody remarks on that letter because he was such a good writer too.
Yes. No, he was very articulate gaslighter.
Yeah.
But it was also just such like, it could have come out of, and I guess it did come out of a time capsule of a grown man explaining to his young daughter why it was important. He was just getting this thing on with this actress and thought it, you know, it's really important to him that it work, and it would really throw a spanner into things if, you know, yeah. God forbid his daughter showed up in this new relationship he was trying to craft, clearly without any input from his family.
So,
you just, kid, you just mess it up for me, okay? So don't come home. I know you have nowhere to go this summer, but.
And then, you know, and then what he's doing in this letter is sort of conning me into going and doing Shakespeare for the summer, into an internship at a Shakespeare festival. And so, of course, I finally said, all right, fine, I'll go do Shakespeare. And I was an actress. I mean, I was at school at Buxton. I had discovered my love of theater and had been, you know, starring in the plays there. So, I mean, it wasn't a bad idea on its face, but the whole reason of it was just for it was terrible. And then I got sent for 2 months to live alone in Lakewood, Ohio. At first, I was given a room in an old mansion that belonged to a like 89-year-old lady who had, her grandfather had built the house. The whole family had lived in this house. And I was sort of there in the attic and like going and doing my theater gig, you know, which was basically, you know, I had to clean all the blood off the stage in Titus Andronicus, you know, those were my kinds of jobs. And I also got stat raped while I was at the theater festival that summer by one of the actors there. I mean, it was just there was nowhere for me to go in that time.
Right. And this is one of, I mean, let's just talk about this. This was one of a series of, as you point out, from a very young age, your first boyfriend at Buxton thought it would be a good idea to kind of gang rape you. Mm-hmm. There's a star of the theater who you were 16, I think.
Yeah.
Who decided to use you. You were sent on one of these like outward bound like trips, and a counselor on that decides, you know, to use you. And what is so heartbreaking about the way you've written this book is you've gone back into the mind of the age you were then. So it's the reader is feeling for you and also watching you blame yourself for these things and not understanding, oh, you know, I guess this is what love is. I guess this is what sex is. Maybe if I have sex with him, he'll like me more. And it's just wrenching to read.
That's one of the things I really wanted to do and why I wrote it so sort of novelistically. So, you know, I really wanted to tell the story and I really wanted to put my reader into my own shoes, because the things that I'm describing, you know, only in a couple of cases was I raped in the classic definition of it, you know, held down and forced into intercourse against my will. And then in these other situations, like with this guy, this kayak instructor on this summer program and the actor and whatever, you know, I was a willing participant in those encounters, even though I was a child, you know, and they were all men in their 30s. And I really wanted my reader to see, to feel that gray area, to feel what was at stake for me, what I wanted, you know, what I was looking for, what I perceived in those predators that made me, you know, concede to the arrangement that in the end wasn't going to benefit me. It was only going to benefit them. And I knew so little about sex, and also these sort of predatory relationships were being modeled everywhere, not only at the Buxton School, but in the culture at large. You know, I mean, I went from the Dalton School, where Jeffrey Epstein was, you know, walking the hallways as a math teacher, where, you know, I was spotted by a casting director for Louis Malle, who was casting the child prostitute for Pretty Baby. And Barr, I'm suddenly forgetting his name, but this is Bill Barr's father, Donald Barr, who was our headmaster at the time, allowed the film company to come and look in the classrooms for young girls to be cast in this role. I mean, can you imagine? And of course, I was asked to come audition, and I wanted to. And it was my mother who said, no, you're not going to do that. My father was irate. He wanted me to go do it too. I mean, everything was so saturated in those days.
Right. And when these things happen to you, you take it as kind of normal. That's what happens. You don't see it in this dynamic of what is a 30-year-old man doing with a 16-year-old girl. You think, oh, I must be very mature and attractive to.
Maybe he loves me.
Maybe he's really into me.
Yeah.
And then this catastrophic sort of mindset led you to the sort of penultimate incident at Buxton, if
yeah.
you call it that.
Yeah. So in the spring of my senior year, and as I said, I fell in love with the school and I thrived there. I mean, it was a wonderful, wonderful place, magical in many ways. You know, I discovered my intellect. I discovered my talent for acting. I discovered how to like bullshit with friends and be in a community. I mean, it was a really amazing place. And then 6 weeks before graduation, there was a teaching couple there who had come in my junior year, and I had become very good friends with them. The woman, the wife was my French teacher, and I loved her. And the husband was a music teacher, and I wasn't involved in the music program at Buxton at all. So I had no classes with him, but I mean, it was a campus of 100 souls. I mean, it was a tiny place. So everybody is having all their meals together. It's, you know, we're living together. So 6 weeks before graduation, this guy asks me, he was also teaching in the music program at Bennington, asked me to take some photographs for a program for an upcoming concert. And I did. And it was a very intense night. We were alone in his apartment, and I shot like 6 rolls of film. And by the end of it, I had a massive crush on him. It had never really occurred to me to have a crush on this teacher, but suddenly I did. Well, it turned out it was mutual. And before long, he told me that he was madly in love with me, and this was the most important thing that had ever happened to him, and we should be together. And we consummated the relationship in the woods. And then 1 week later, we were found out. And when we were found out, he was fired, of course. And I was told they couldn't expel me from the school because I was still their responsibility. But the wife wanted to remain at the school and finish her teaching year. And they felt that it would be too upsetting for the wife if I remained in the school, and it would be too upsetting for the other students if I remained in the school. And my parents weren't there. My father wouldn't even talk to me. He was so furious.
So they call your parents and
they called, but I never spoke to them about it. I agreed without counsel from my parents to leave the school. And that was late afternoon. So I packed up my things that night and I was sort of spirited away early the very next morning. And that was it. Nobody ever saw me again at the school. So yeah, it was a really deeply traumatic experience for me. And I went and I lived with the teacher for a few weeks in North Bennington. And part of the reason why all of this happened, again, we're talking about parental responsibility. So my father was like, "You're a fuck up, Erica, and I'm so mad at you. I'm not even going to talk to you, and I'm not going to give you any money, and you're on your own." And my mother, who I had always been in this adversarial relationship with, was like, "Come to my bosom, my darling girl." So she was living with David down on the Cape, and I went down there.
This is the father of your former best
friend. Yes. Who still wasn't speaking to me.
Yeah.
And I went down the Cape and I learned from my mother that when she was at Sarah Lawrence, she had had a love affair with a professor there. And I had never really known that. And I had known, she had told me stories about working once in college on a psychological study. And this guy was a psych professor. And he was sort of on loan to Sarah Lawrence, but went back to Harvard, which is where he spent most of his career. And when he left, my mother got a Woodrow Wilson fellowship and followed him to Harvard to study psychology just to be near him. So...
And he was married, let's...
And he was married.
Yeah.
And according to my father and according to my mother's childhood best friend who went to Sarah, they went to Sarah Lawrence together and were roommates their freshman year, that it was a triad. She was actually sleeping with him and his wife. And the experience completely changed her, according to her friend, that she had been... this funny, light, compassionate, just a sparkling girl. And this, by the time she got out of college, she was heartbroken and bitter and just essentially different and had been shaped into the mother that I knew eventually. Yeah.
And it gets very creepy when your mother sort of approves of this, of what had happened to you. Your father even meets the professor and at one point, I think to pick you up from somewhere or something. And I mean, he should have just punched the guy in the face, but he didn't.
Oh yeah. No, and it wasn't it was to pick me up, but whether this is how the affair ended was, so, you know, I spent 6 weeks living with the guy in North Bennington, and he decided things got very, we were broke and he had no work. And I had actually been accepted to Sarah Lawrence before the affair even happened that spring at school. I had applied to and gotten accepted by Sarah Lawrence. I was going to go to my mother's alma mater in the fall. And we were trying to figure out how to sort of make the whole thing work. And then one day we went for a drive and he said, "I'm sorry, I have to have the car to be able to find jobs. You have to go back to your father's house in New York." And I said, "There's no way." And he said, "It's too late. I called him last night and he's on his way." And we didn't have a phone in the apartment, so he had called from Bennington College. And that's how that ended. I never saw him again. So I began adulthood with these losses, you know, the initial loss of the love and regard of my mother, and being sent away to boarding school, and then the loss of the boarding school, this ersatz family I had found for myself, and then the loss of this terrible asshole that had taken advantage of me and changed my life. I mean, it changed the whole course of my life.
How did it change the course of your life, do you think? Like, what do you think would have happened had this not happened? You obviously would have graduated and with honors, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very bohemian school, so they didn't have like an honors program. There were no AP classes. I was a straight A student. I was a success story. You know, I'd come in troubled with terrible grades. And by the end, I was in charge of all these committees and, you know, work program crews. And I was a real figure. I mean, again, my graduating class was around 20 people. So nobody was taken for granted in that school. But even in that sort of area, I stood out. I was a big personality in the school. And Yeah. So all of that, what changed for me was that it's sort of this identity, this shame got fused into my self-identity. And I, at that point, I was had been so convinced that I was a dirty girl, a bad girl, a slut, a fuck up, you know, all of these things, that I spent my early adulthood just trying to prove everybody wrong, trying to prove my worth, that I was a good person, that I, and so I went into a marriage that was probably a bad idea. I mean, turned out to be a bad idea. We had 10 good years together and created two beautiful children together. But it was the wrong, I always knew it was, he was the wrong person for me.
How old were you when you got married?
Oh God, I'm trying to remember. 91. So I was like 26 or 5 when I got married. So yeah. Yeah. Which at the time was sort of young for people my age to do that. And I was the first in my cohort to get pregnant and have children.
Same. Same.
Yeah.
And it was, I remember that. Yeah. It was a weird thing to get married. Why would you get married? It's just a piece of paper, right?
Well, for me, I had an agenda, you know, I was going to do everything right. I was going to do everything opposite of what my parents did, you know, and I was going to prove that I could be a good parent and a good person. And that is no way to live your life. That is not an authentic way to live. And I did all kinds of things to sort of run away from this story. I never really looked back at what happened to me in high school, except for an anecdote. Mm-hmm. And it was in that sort of mad dash to get away from the deep, deep hurt I felt that I ran into the arms of Sam Spade, who is the second part of this book.
Right. And yeah. Sam Spade, we can just say, I'll say, is the pseudonym for James Ellroy, the well-known crime writer, mm-hmm. whom you got involved with when your own kid, your eldest, was about the same age your parents got divorced.
Yes. Yeah.
You do like these patterns, Erica. Well, I noticed. You just love these patterns.
This is the thing about this book, which is what sort of, you know, I mean, if I may flatter myself to say, you know, it's a deeply personal story, but I really feel like it's a meta story that, you know, there is a point of this, it's that anybody can find themselves at some point inside of this story, especially any woman of an age will find herself somewhere. You know, the circumstances can be different, but those themes that we were dealing with and those sort of that sort of rush to sophistication that was being so prized by my parents and the culture of the 70s. I mean, remember, we have Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver. We have, you know, we have Pretty Baby. We have Manhattan. We have all of these examples of where girls are. I mean, I was Tracy in Manhattan. I mean, that was exactly who I was, a child with this sort of false personality of sophistication engineered to please the actual adults.
Right. And so why, I mean, at this, now you're no longer, you're a mother now, you've been married for a number of years, you're an adult. And so it's not the same thing as being taken advantage of by a teacher, obviously, when you're a young girl, mm-hmm. but you felt exploited in the end by this man, correct?
Which man are we talking about? The teacher?
No, Ellroy.
Ellroy.
AKA Sam Spade.
You know, I have to say, we exploited each other. And, you know, the moment I met him, and I described this in the book, I had this feeling of just deep, deep recognition that he was like every boy I had a crush on in high school. You know, I really liked the sort of brilliant, kind of nerdy, not completely handsome, sort of obsessive smart boys, you know, I didn't, you know, so he was all of that. And you know, I think what animated me towards him, I became obsessed with him. I was obsessed with him for 2 years before we ever finally made contact with each other. And when I say obsessed, I don't mean like, you know, I thought about him day and night. I did think about him at night. I held him as a sort of imaginary lover in my mind, that I knew that he was out there thinking about me. I knew it. And as I was trying to negotiate the sort of cage of a marriage that had gone completely flat, and the task of trying to write a memoir, because I started out just trying to write about what happened to me in high school. I had no idea that any of this was coming. So I used him as much as he used me. So as a vehicle to, you know, as a getaway car from the things I didn't want to confront.
Right. And then with him, you found yourself being molded into another pleasing
yes
type that was also not yeah you.
So the relationship was deeply Oedipal, right? So, you know, big mid-century, super prolific writer dude. Well, that would be my father, you know? I mean, the was not lost on either me or Elroy that we were enacting a sort of an Oedipal compact in some way together. And I was the replacement. All his life he had been looking for her, you know, and her being the replacement for his famously murdered mother, who was a pale-skinned, red-headed Midwestern woman. And I sort of checked all those boxes for him.
Right. And that then, and you write about that obsession that you had and then its constraints, and finally having to break out of it in order to, I guess, complete this memoir, but also complete yourself or find yourself, as we once said.
Yeah, as we used to say. Yeah, I mean, the finding of the self is a different matter. The relationship ended because he ended it, not because I did. I would have stayed in there because part of my psychology is I like to throw myself, and this is his line, I like to throw myself at the empty spaces inside of people. You know, because I was raised by these parents, what all I want to do is to be approved of and loved by the sort of parental figure, which was Elroy in that case. So, and we had reached the limits of what he could bear, because he has his own very twisted psychology and he's a crazy man. I mean, in the end, it would have been the greatest relationship of my life if he hadn't been such a terrified, damaged human being.
Right. And in the end, this memoir is very poignant about trauma on all fronts, and especially in your case, how early trauma, especially if it's not regarded as trauma, just reaches its hand through time and keeps clutching you by the throat.
Yeah. And I really look at sort of intergenerational trauma in this book. You know, I trace, you know, when I started looking at the story after I sort of survived the trauma of Elroy breaking my heart, which really took me like 3 or 4 years to recover from. I was trying to, and I hadn't read The Body Keeps the Score because it hadn't been published yet. And I wish I had, because that's a fantastic book around trauma and really opened my eyes to some facets of this that I hadn't understood before. But I did come to see that I was dealing with a trauma and a shame that had in part been handed down to me through a matrilinear line in my family. It wasn't just my mother, but it was also my great aunt Frances, who grew up in Seattle at the turn of the century, of the 20th century. Was seduced by her English teacher in high school and married him at the age of 16. And that's a marriage that lasted 2 years. So, and she, my great aunt Frances, was my heroine. I learned about her my sophomore year in high school. I didn't even know I had such a relative in my family. And I wrote to her And we had a long correspondence together over the years. And she was a genuinely, a deeply powerful, ambitious, incredible woman. But she too had been sort of formed by this thing, you know, this strange early and inappropriate relationship. So yeah, I'm really trying to understand, you know, how much of this did I just absorb, you know, in the environment or in the womb or through my mother's, you know, behavior with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you bring it kind of full circle towards the end by referencing Me Too and the anger behind it, because it's not just that you're mad at predatory men, you're also mad at the institutions that enabled it, like at Buxton, where you wrote there was a culture of teachers mm-hmm. having relationships with their students. So you were really startled and then scapegoated, like the idea that the student would be punished in this. I mean, he was too, to be fair, he was fired, but you were, as you say, hustled off the property like a, you
know. He was fired, but of course, Buxton never called Bennington to let them know that they had a predator on their faculty.
This has all come out years later. You noted that these private institutions, these schools, and especially these boarding schools, turned out to be hotbeds of predatory.
Right. And in 2013, I actually was contacted by the Boston Globe Spotlight team because they were doing an investigation into sexual abuse in private boarding schools. And, you know, they were doing a whole series on it because all of this stuff was coming out. One aspect that they were trying to illustrate was the students who were punished, who got punished for the thing. And so I gave them a long interview and they put me on the cover of the Boston Globe Sunday edition, which is, of course, the Buxton School is in Massachusetts, you know, and I thought for sure they would. And of course, the Globe, the researchers contacted Buxton and fact checked everything and found the teacher and, you know, who didn't want to talk. Imagine that. So this was on, you know, I thought surely that Buxton would go, oh my God, you know, oh, Erica, this was a long time ago, but this is awful. We're so sorry this ever happened. But it was crickets. Meanwhile, on one school after another is reckoning with their own past and, you know, putting out formal apologies, loading them up onto the school websites, you know, setting up programs for victims to get counseling, all of this stuff. Silence from Buxton. And then finally, I think it was 2018, I got an email from a friend, you know, a group email saying, come to the reunion in New York. And I was sort of in a bad mood that day. And I just sort of wrote, why the fuck would I do that? Mm-hmm. And it started this exchange rolling that wound up in a letter being written to the trustees of the school and the administration of the school and saying, this Erica's going to stand up and raise her hand as this, but is speaking for so many students. And many students got in touch with me after the Globe piece ran, because, of course, I wasn't the only one who experienced that at Buxton and elsewhere. And then they sort of came back with like a really insulting letter that sort of describes them as romantic relationships, student-teacher relationships. I mean, it was very condescending and tone deaf. And then ultimately they sent another letter saying, you know, we acknowledge this, and here is this program to help pay for your therapy. But, you know, I don't think they're going to pay for 30 years of therapy that I've done around this. So, yeah, they have not comported themselves well in any way.
So was this cathartic for you? Has this writing this deeply personal memoir? I mean, I do wonder if Elroy has read it or if you'll ever know. But. Yeah. Certainly your daughters are going to read it.
I assume. Well, my eldest has read it And my youngest is, I think, struggling. I don't know. I don't think she's even read my first book at this point. So who knows? But my eldest loved the book. And, you know,
so she didn't, go, oh, mom, TMI. I didn't need
to. No, not at all. Not at all. No. So very supportive. And Elroy, I have to say, is I never expected to hear from him. I don't expect to hear from him. When we last spoke, he said, we will never speak again. And I know that that to be the truth. And I also know that he's not a litigious person. And I know that he, you know, for all of his failings as a human being, of which there are many, I still believe in the essential goodness of him. And that's one of the things that I learned by writing this book, you know, that the only way to heal is to find compassion. And, you know, and that begins with yourself. You know, I really, you know, the book was an exercise in me going back as an adult and looking at the child I was and describing that child and taking that child back into my heart. And allowing her to be not a bad girl, but just a very hurt girl. And you know, I mean, I know it's sort of pop psychology 101, but it's genuinely, oh, pardon the clock ringing. It's genuinely an act of reparenting, and it's essential. And that once you have forgiven yourself and shown yourself compassion, it becomes easier to do that with other people.
Well, and as you pointed out, his mother was problematic to begin with, was murdered and raped when he was 10 years old.
When he was 10. But I mean, I think the fix was in long before she was murdered. I mean, she was a dreadful mother and he had a dreadful father, you know, and I think that, you know, he got shaped very early on by that, the dynamic there, and that he probably would have been a hot mess without the murder. But the murder is the piece that made him impossible to be with, because there's a place inside of him that is so irrational with fear that he cannot have a genuine sexual romantic connection with a woman because it's far too threatening.
Right.
And to be with me every day was torture for him, because he loved me so much that that meant that I would be taken from him by another man.
Yeah. Well, that you, and you write about how controlling and paranoid he was. Well, Erica, this is just such an amazing memoir. I think our mutual friend, Caitlin Flanagan, wrote that once she had finished reading it, she wanted to sit down and read it all again. And I feel the same way. And I feel, I just want to go back to those 70s moments and just try remember what we were all coping with. And, you know, I was lucky. I had my parents divorced and I had the swingers on one side and then an incredibly stable set on my mother's side. So I got a sort of straddled view of that whole strange world that it was. But it was...
Yeah.
It was a strange time to be a child. And I think now we know why our generation has created these swaddled, protected little Gen Z-er kids, because.
You know, and it's funny, I did not helicopter my kids, you know, and I don't know why, except that that was the example I was raised with. So, you know, I tried to helicopter because I understood that what was lacking in my childhood was attention being paid, but you know, my kids lucked out. I didn't swaddle, but
but you can see the impulse and where it comes from.
Absolutely.
When you look back on how we grew up,
it's so valid.
Maybe the Gen Zers will be like the most neglectful parents ever. And, you know, as a result,
go we the shall other way. See, but the grandparents will surely swoop in.
All right, Erica. Well, thank you again so much. The book is The Big Hurt, and can't recommend it enough.
Thank you so much, Danielle. It's been great.
Okay, well, I hope you all enjoyed that. I think I'll have to go back into therapy for the next 20 years. But anyway, it was the 70s. So we'll see you. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. The Femsplainers is a weekly podcast carried on the Podcast One Network. Matt Frum produces and edits our audio and video. You can follow us on Twitter and FB at Femsplainers and on Instagram at Femsplainers Podcast. We love hearing from you. You can reach out to us via email at contact@femsplainers.com. You'll find all our episodes and more information about me and the podcast at femsplainers.com. And remember, we rely on your donations to keep this podcast going. So please consider supporting us at patreon.com/femsplainers.